In the pre-dawn hours, Sacramento County dispatchers received a message from Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell, notifying them that he was pulling over a white van for a license plate violation. 7 minutes passed when suddenly Deputy Mitchell's radio clicked. Seconds later, it clicked again, then silence. Concerned, dispatch tried to get a response, but there was no answer. All units were directed to his last known location, but they never imagined what they'd find. Deputy Mitchell had been shot and was lying motionless behind his vehicle, his gun and handcuffs on the ground nearby. It was clear that a desperate and violent struggle had occurred, resulting in Deputy Mitchell receiving a lethal head wound. An urgent search began for the white van and the killer believed to be driving it. 12 hours later, investigators located the van, but what they hoped would provide insight only deepened the mystery. Inside were two bodies, a man and a woman, though their cause of death was unclear. Quickly, police began to wonder, had these two killed Deputy Mitchell, or was it possible the officer had pulled over a killer en route to dumping the bodies? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 150, The Murder of Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today, we examine the terrible murder of Sacramento County Sheriff's Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Any police officer will tell you there's no such thing as a routine traffic stop. In fact, traffic stops have, year after year, resulted in more line-of-duty injuries and deaths than any other police action. You never know exactly who you're stopping or what intentions they may have. For Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell, what began as a simple license plate violation quickly escalated into a fight for his life. This is episode 150, The Murder of Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell. The screaming wail of police sirens sliced through the pre-dawn silence as multiple units left the grumbling din of Sacramento behind. Busy city streets painted in the glow of neon lights made way for the darkness of vacant rural roads, now illuminated only by headlights, and the whirling storm of red and blue strobes reverberating against the countryside. Deputy Ron Sutter was nearly there, having sharply spun his cruiser and changed course as soon as dispatch issued the call. As his cruiser roared towards the intersection, he could see the glowing pool of headlights piercing the night, but something was clearly wrong. It wasn't the light which made his heart pound against his chest, but the eerie stillness which surrounded it. Exiting his vehicle, Sutter raced towards the black and white unit parked at the side of the road. Less than 10 minutes earlier, Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell had notified dispatch of a traffic stop involving a white van, but then had gone silent, not answering multiple calls on either his radio or cell phone. As Sutter made his way towards the rear of the patrol unit, he came to understand the horrifying reason why. Deputy Mitchell lies still on the ground, his service revolver and handcuffs not far away. As a second deputy came speeding up the street, Sutter leaned down to check on Mitchell while urgently calling code 999 into his radio. Officer down. The scene was a terrifying story. Somehow, what had begun as a traffic stop had quickly spun out of control. It was clear there had been a desperate struggle, with Deputy Mitchell fighting for his life against an unknown assailant who, prior to fleeing the scene, had fired at the deputy, striking him in the head. As Mitchell was being airlifted to the University of California Davis Medical Center, investigators joined by local police, neighboring sheriff's department, and the FBI launched a massive search for the van and the shooter. Tragically, Deputy Mitchell, a 9-year veteran of the Sacramento Sheriff's Department, a husband and a father, would succumb to his wounds less than an hour later, and the search for an armed assailant would transform into the hunt for a cop killer. Jeffrey Vaughn Mitchell was born on Tuesday, May 28, 1968, to parents Gary and Mary. Jeff was raised in the city of Campbell in the San Francisco Bay Area. From a young age, Jeff developed a passion for sports, specifically baseball, his favorite team being the Giants. Baseball was something which would stick with him for life, as he would play it throughout much of his youth, and later, he'd coach his son. Whenever people speak about him, whether they're discussing his early years or the later years of his life, the most common remark made revolves around Jeff's smile. Jeff, referred to by some as having a good-natured prankster side, was often smiling or laughing, and it seems that smile stuck with people. It's mentioned by everyone, high school classmates to coworkers. In researching this case, I have found more references to Jeff's smile and kind personality than anything else. Paul Kelly, a childhood friend, talked about growing up with Jeff, who never really found himself in much trouble, but as all kids do, he'd walk the line from time to time. As Kelly put it, quote, "You wouldn't call him a narrow goody-two-shoes. He got into the same scrapes as the rest of us, but he was the first one to say, 'No, I did wrong,' or 'Here's how I can help.' He always had that damn smile on his face, too." End quote. As Jeff grew up, he developed a unique perspective on the world, always trying to find the best in a bad situation. His optimism and belief in doing right was supported by his own selfless nature, and while his later pursuit of law enforcement surprised some, others felt it was right up his alley. Doug Thurman explained, quote, "Jeff was one of those guys who could cheer a room up. He was someone whose first instinct was to think about others instead of himself." End quote. Jeff grew up playing baseball in the Campbell Little League, and even from a young age showed talent and promise. He attended Capri Elementary School, followed by Rolling Hills Middle, where he developed a reputation as a kid who had time for everyone, and went out of his way to make everyone feel welcome. Amy Brickmont, who attended early school with him, explained, quote, "I knew Jeff since we were in kindergarten. He was never mean or snotty, even though he was popular and handsome. I will always remember his twinkly blue eyes and his ready smile. He was truly a good guy." End quote. After aging out of Little League, Jeff spent some time playing in the Campbell-Moreland Pony League, where he continued to shine, playing alongside his brother and under the leadership of his father, who managed the team before moving up to the Colt League. Jeff went on to attend Westmont High School, where he continued to excel at baseball, as well as participating in other sports, including basketball. Jeff played baseball all 4 years, making the varsity team and earning a spot on the All-League First Team as a senior outfielder for the Championship Club in 1986. Jeff played center field for Westmont and was noted as being one of, if not the hardest-working players on the team. His love for the game and drive to succeed shone through in his knowledge and ability, and his focus on always remaining physically fit. Chris Bailey, who played alongside Jeff, remembered him as being both extremely serious about the game, but rarely losing his optimism regardless of the situation. Bailey explained, quote, "What I remember most about Jeff during those years was that he was a winner, through and through. There was nothing routine about a ground ball hit by Jeff Mitchell, because he had every intention on beating out that play, and he had the speed to do it. Those few times he didn't beat that play were the only times I didn't see him wearing his famous smile, but that didn't last long. Jeff's smile made you smile, and you just couldn't help it." End quote. Jeff graduated from Westmont in the spring of 1986, and while friends and family expected him to go on to college in pursuit of a career as a teacher or maybe a coach, he surprised everyone when he enlisted in the Air Force. In uniform, Jeff continued to develop his selfless reputation while showing his meticulous nature. More often than not, Jeff would win days off, which were awarded to the sharpest man in uniform. However, rather than taking all these days for himself, Jeff frequently gave them away to others who he felt needed the time more than he did. Terrell Jones, a friend who served with Jeff, recalled, quote, "People would say, is he really that nice?" End quote. While in the Air Force, Jeff joined his squadron's softball team, where he showed off his skill and love of the game, all while wearing that signature smile. In addition to playing ball, Jeff would go on to become a member of the then security police, known today as the security forces. During his enlistment, Jeff would serve in Kuwait during the Persian Gulf War. After 5 years with the Air Force, Jeff decided to move on to new things. Reportedly, Jeff had decided he wanted to go to college to begin building his future with the aim of eventually becoming a high school teacher or coach. When enrolling at California State University, Sacramento, he had no way of knowing that he would find much more than a degree on campus. It was at CSU Sacramento that he would meet and fall in love with Crystal Gerringer. The couple's relationship would develop, and not long after graduating with a degree in teaching, Jeff proposed and Crystal accepted. The two were married in August of 95 when Jeff was 27 years old. Crystal has said Jeff was not only her best friend, but the best husband she could ever ask for. It was clear to everyone around them that in one another they had found what they were always looking for, and the love they shared was obvious in their every glance and touch. For a few years after graduating, Jeff worked as a substitute teacher, according to the Sacramento Bee. For whatever reason, though, he found himself being pulled towards something different. And in 1997, he took a job with the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department, working at the Rio Casumnas Correctional Center in Elk Grove. Jeff worked as a physical education instructor, and while the dynamic between inmates and guards is often volatile, Jeff continued to show his optimism and inclusivity by going above and beyond to not just run the program, but to get the inmates involved. Whereas in the past, it was a matter of supplying equipment and letting them do their own thing, Jeff wanted to do more. As Doug Thurman explained, quote, "He wouldn't just roll out the balls. He'd actually design programs for them." End quote. 3 years later, things would change for Jeff in two very important ways. Jeff graduated from the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department Academy in 2000. This was a major step in his career as he hoped to transition out of the correctional facility and into a patrol unit. Excited as he may have been at the time, this would capture second place for that year, as he and Crystal would welcome their first and only child, a son named Jake. And from that day forward, Jeff took all of his humor, devotion, and love and dedicated it to being the best father he possibly could. Along the way, he would instill his optimism and morals, as well as his love for sports and his joyful attitude in his son. 2 years later, in 2002, Jeff finally moved on from the correctional facility, being assigned to solo duty in a patrol unit. Wanting to be around for his family as much as he could, he volunteered for the least popular shift, asking to work graveyard. While being on patrol all night could wear people down quickly, Jeff was happy to do it, as it afforded him the ability to be home during the day with his son and to be around to have dinner with the family each night. It wasn't uncommon for Crystal to arrive home, finding Jeff in the final stages of completing dinner for the family. Jeff wanted to be with his family, to support them, to protect them, and to be enjoying every moment he had with them. As Crystal later told the Sacramento Bee, quote, "He was everything as a person you'd hope a dad would be. He taught Jake how to be a good person and a kind person, and he made sure there wasn't a day that went by that he didn't spend time with us." End quote. In 2003, Jeff and Crystal picked up stakes and moved to El Dorado Hills. At the time, the area was known as being a hub for young families, and they wanted to have a community for themselves and their son to be a part of. Over the course of the next few years, Jeff masterfully balanced being a present, loving father and husband with the ceaseless call of duty. According to Crystal, Jeff frequently watched games on television with his son, and if there were none on, he'd take him to a local high school to watch one live. If nobody was playing there, father and son would head down to the park and play their own game. When Jake joined Little League, Jeff was right there with him, becoming a coach for El Dorado Hills South. During his early patrol years, Jeff earned praise from supervisors and the local community alike. Deputy Mike Baer described Jeff to the Sacramento Bee, saying he was extremely mature and educated about his job, more so than you'd expect from someone who hadn't been doing it for most of their life. Bear went on to explain that Jeff's combination of energy, calm under pressure, and compassion helped diffuse situations which could have easily turned volatile. Jeff was patrolling out of the Southern Bureau, and his beat extended southeast of Sacramento, carrying him into much more isolated areas. While some believe that working in the city comes with greater dangers than the more rural locations, many deputies disagree, saying it's quite the opposite. As Lieutenant Les Lovell put it, in an urban area, a criminal may hesitate knowing backup is seconds away, but in rural areas, you could be 15 or 20 minutes out from the closest backup. And quote, if a criminal thinks he might have the opportunity to get the drop on you, they're more inclined to do so. End quote. While the more rural area provides dangers, there were aspects of it that Jeff truly appreciated. The more urban-based law enforcement operates under a tighter time constraint, with calls coming in more frequently. Out there, Jeff had the opportunity to get to know the locals, to spend extra time with someone who needed help or was going through a rough situation. One woman, who chose to remain nameless, described Jeff as an angel. According to her story, she had reached a low point in her life and was struggling to make it when she ran into Jeff. In her own words, quote, he helped me through a tough time and treated me with dignity and respect that I didn't even realize I deserved. His kindness and gentle heart is the only reason I am standing before you today. I wish there was some way I could thank him for giving me a second chance at life. End quote. There is, of course, a dark side in the more rural areas. Over the course of the past two decades, the rise of drugs such as methamphetamine have changed the dynamic. Whereas police face greater violence and risk working in cities and more populated areas in the past, statistics show a tremendous rise in violence in rural areas. While this is the result of a number of factors, from drugs such as meth to the opioid epidemic, from closing factories and lost businesses to rising poverty and the steady decline of community relations, multiple studies have shown the risk of severe injury or death has been steadily rising, even doubling and tripling in some rural areas. While Jeff has been described as the type of deputy others looked up to, both for his compassion and his skill, there's also the difficult reality some officers believe, which suggests that while being caring, calm, and personable can often help, there are times when being more stern and suspicious take prominence. To be guarded, and to maintain that shield with a tendency towards aggressive command of a situation rather than calm negotiation is considered by many officers the best way to ensure you make it home every night. Sacramento County Sheriff John McGinnis, when speaking to The Bee, explained, quote, throughout the years, it's the officers who tend to be nice guys, easygoing and quick with a smile, who are most likely to be killed in the line of duty. It's sad, but true. End quote. By the fall of 2006, Jeff was 38 years old and working for the Sheriff's Department for 9 years now. No matter what, though, Jeff maintained his bright personality, and many of his coworkers noted that he made a tough job seem more tolerable, whether he was taking time to give advice to rookies or making his comrades laugh. His schedule consisted of leaving home in the evening hours, typically around 9 or 10 p.m., and arriving home 10 to 12 hours later, between 7 and 9 a.m. During a shift, he could run into any number of situations, from violent and dangerous confrontations to missing persons and property crimes. While he never knew how his night would end, he always knew how it would begin. Backing out of his driveway in his patrol unit, Jeff would shine his spotlight into the window of his now 6-year-old son's bedroom, who would lift himself up to wave. With his trademark smile, Jeff would click on the PA and announce loudly, "Hey, Jake Mitchell, go to bed." Jeff would smile as he drove down the road, heading towards another overnight shift. It had become routine, but Jeff never failed to get a good laugh out of it. Tragically, no one had any way of knowing that on the evening of Thursday, October 26th, he would play that little prank for the final time. As far as we know, it wasn't an exceedingly busy night for the Sheriff's Department that Thursday. While there were multiple crimes committed within the city, according to the daily log activity reports supplied by the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department, there were few incidents reported in which sheriff's deputies were dispatched to respond. As the hours passed, The temperature steadily dropped from 75 degrees in the afternoon to 50 degrees at midnight. As the clock wound past 12, the calendar swung to Friday, October 27th. Jeff was nearly halfway through his shift, halfway home, but just over 3 hours into the new day, everything that could go wrong would go wrong. Jeff was patrolling in an unincorporated area known as Slough House and was approximately 30 miles southeast of downtown Sacramento. During his patrol, he turned off Jackson Road, California State Route 16, moving on to Dillard Road. This is a fairly open area filled with farms and ranches, with many residents living in homes set a ways back from the road. Just over 5 miles south of Route 16, Dillard intersects with Mace Road, which runs 4 miles east to west, from Ione Road to the Cosumnes River. It's a thin, paved road with no shoulder that, for the majority of its stretch, is bordered on both sides by wire fences and open farmland. During the day, it's a beautiful-looking stretch of landscape, but at night, it's exceedingly dark, and there are no lights along the way. Sometime, estimated to be between 3:20 and 3:25 a.m., Jeff came upon a white Chevy van moving along Mace Road. The van, by itself, is a bit strange as it's moving down a rural road in the middle of the night, essentially in the middle of nowhere. As Jeff's cruiser got closer, he took note that the van had no plates, and so he decided to initiate a traffic stop, at which time he planned to issue a ticket for plate violation, as well as determining what the van was doing in the area. At 3:27 a.m., Jeff accessed the computer in his vehicle and typed a message to dispatch. According to investigators, Jeff explained that he was stopping a white van with no plates in the area of Dillard and Mace Roads. The details are a bit unclear here, but Jeff either included in his first message that he could see one occupant in the van and everything seemed okay, or he sent a second message relaying that information. Over the course of the next 7 minutes, the traffic stop would turn deadly. At 3:34 a.m., Jeff's radio was keyed, meaning that the push-to-talk button was pressed, but rather than hearing someone speaking, dispatch only received a clicking noise. Seconds later, the radio was keyed again. While this isn't exactly uncommon, the dispatcher felt something was wrong and immediately tried to reach Jeff on the radio, but received no response. Within seconds, the dispatcher placed a call to Jeff's cell phone, which rang, but was never answered. Before the clock could change to 3:35 a.m., the dispatcher relayed Jeff's last known location and issued a code 3, an emergency call telling all units to proceed to the location immediately. Some agencies refer to this as a hot response, and it tells responding units to utilize lights and sirens and that speed is a priority. Within seconds, multiple units were flying towards Jeff, though the excessive dark of the area and curving roads would limit their ability to travel at high speed the entire way. The exact time of arrival for the first deputy on scene is somewhat unclarified, as while some sources report it took up to 15 minutes, others state that Deputy Sutter, the first to arrive, pulled up to Jeff's cruiser at 3:37 a.m., 10 minutes after Jeff's initial report of the stop, and 3 minutes after the code 3 was issued. When Sutter found Jeff, he was lying on the pavement behind the rear bumper of his vehicle, and based on the amount of blood, he knew he was severely injured. Sutter radioed in that they had an officer down and to send emergency medical services immediately. Simultaneously, the second deputy arrived at the scene, and together they began performing first aid on Jeff in an attempt to save his life. Paramedics arrived at 3:59 a.m. and took over life-saving procedures for the deputies while preparing Jeff to be medevaced to UC Davis Medical Center. In a truly haunting description of the scene, Deputy Sutter commented on a memorial page for Jeff and described watching as EMTs worked on him. Deputy Sutter wrote, quote, "I was the first one to find you at the scene, man. I wish there was more I could have done for you. The one thing that will always stay with me is while the EMTs were working on you, I got to see a glimpse of that smile. Whatever it was you saw must have been wonderful. Godspeed, my brother." End quote. During the time Jeff was being prepped and flown out, Units continued arriving and began locking down the scene, blocking roads and assessing what may have happened. Since Jeff had specifically noted he was stopping a white van, a notice was put out to multiple departments to be on the lookout for a white van with no plates. The initial report had come in at 3:27, so the van had a head start, but given the dark conditions and the nature of the roads, it was believed the driver likely couldn't have been more than 15 or 20 miles away. A message was quickly delivered to the changeable message sign system, which is spread out all along California freeways. The bright orange letters blazed out the disturbing message: "Officer shot. White Chevy van. No plates." Within an hour of the shooting, the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department was joined by the FBI, California Highway Patrol, and several neighboring police and sheriff's departments. All white vans within 100 miles of the scene were stopped and searched while the drivers were questioned. Over the course of the next 12 hours, police all across the state would stop hundreds of vans. While investigators were examining the scene itself, they discovered several disturbing pieces of evidence. It was noted that Jeff's service revolver was lying on the ground, as were his handcuffs. There were clear indications of what investigators described as a violent struggle, and Jeff had sustained injuries in addition to the gunshot wound, which showed he had been in a brutal fight for his life. Police noted damage to a roadside fence looked fresh and was severe enough that they believed the white van had likely collided with it, causing damage to its front end. Sadly, around the same time investigators were beginning to collect evidence from the scene, they received the sad news. Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell had been pronounced dead at 4:45 a.m. The manhunt, which was in its early stages, was no longer a search for a shooter, but the hunt for a cop killer. Just as Jeff's brothers and sisters-in-arms were learning of his death, a group of officers from the sheriff's department had arrived at the home he shared with his wife and son. Crystal later told reporter Madison Wade of ABC 10 that she was awoken in the middle of the night by her doorbell and loud knocks. As she approached the door, she peered through the windows, and the only thing that stood out to her was, amongst the officers present, was a chaplain. She knew at that moment that Jeff had been killed. Crystal was taken to the hospital, all the while passing the digital freeway signs, their flashing orange letters telling the story of her husband's murder. Crystal was able to see Jeff, though she was advised not to touch him, as they had to preserve evidence which could be on his clothes and body. Lost in the fog of being awoken from her sleep into a living nightmare, it began to dawn on her that she was going to have to tell Jake, just 6 years old, that his father was dead. Crystal explained to ABC 10, quote, "When I sat down with Jake, I didn't even have to say. He asked me, 'Is Daddy dead?' He asked me how he died. I told him a bad man shot Daddy. He wanted to know where, and I told him in the head. And his next question was why the doctors couldn't put a Band-Aid on him and fix him." End quote. At a press conference held Friday morning, Sheriff McGinnis announced that Jeff had been shot and killed by an unknown assailant and they were desperately searching for the white van. At the time, McGinnis shared very few details of the crime, but did implore locals to call in with any tips they might have. It was also noted that since they believed a violent confrontation had occurred, they wanted anyone to call in if they saw someone who was acting out of character and who had injuries to his hands as though he had been in a fight, whether or not they drove a white van, as it was possible the killer could have ditched the vehicle in the hours that had passed. The manhunt continued to expand as the morning transitioned into afternoon. Soon, the Department of Justice became involved in the search, which had, at first, been constrained to within 50 miles of the scene. However, as the day progressed, the search grid continued to grow, topping out at 465 square miles. Police were receiving countless tips from locals, reporting neighbors, friends, and co-workers who drove white vans, and investigators were being sent to track down each lead that came in. The FBI was entering what tips were considered to be most legitimate into a database, as they were receiving calls from a lot of California residents, but the calls had also crossed borders, and many were coming from Nevada. Then, one call came in which caught everyone's attention. A couple, returning to the area from Lake Tahoe, some 100 miles to the northeast, spotted a white van in the shallow waters of the Cosumnes River, just off Highway 49, a few miles north of the town of Plymouth, and approximately 20 miles from the scene of the crime near the El Dorado County line. While investigators rushed to the scene believing the van could break open the case and possibly lead them to the killer, they would soon be faced with a bizarre scene that would provide a hell of a lot more questions than it did answers. When investigators arrived on the scene, they found a white Chevy van stopped in the waters of the river. The river, which looks more like a creek in this area, was fairly shallow, and the water rose up only 8 inches, covering some of the tires, but it surely wouldn't have been defined as submerged. Opening the van, police discovered something they didn't expect. Inside were two bodies, a man and a woman, though there was no outwardly obvious cause of death. According to reports of the time, the male victim was found slumped in the driver's seat, while the female victim was partially on the passenger seat, but leaning and curled as though she had fallen out of place. Just to note, some reports say the woman was found in the rear of the vehicle, though multiple investigators have clarified that she was up front. Police were extremely tight-lipped about the van and the bodies inside. However, they did note that they were working to determine whether or not this was, in fact, the van Jeff had stopped 12 hours earlier. There was a front plate on this van, but it was bent upward, making it possible Jeff may have thought there was no plate. Beyond that, the van had damage to the front end, which could have matched damage to the fence at the scene of the crime. However, when the van was pulled from the river, a rear plate was also seen. This led to two possibilities. Either Jeff had pulled the van over after passing it on the road, meaning he had only noticed the issue with the front plate, or the plate had been put on the rear sometime after he had been killed, possibly in response to notifications being blasted all over California about a white van with no plates. California law requires a license plate on the front and back, so the bent plate could have signaled to Jeff that the vehicle was in violation. The van would quickly become a controversial subject for Sheriff John McGinnis, who just a day after its discovery announced they had found no evidence linking the van nor the two victims to Jeff's murder. This was somewhat strange since the van was still being processed for evidence, and evidence which had been gathered had not yet been analyzed. It was noted that neither victim showed any physical injuries to connect them with a violent struggle like the one Jeff had engaged in before he was shot. The location in which the van had been found was near the borders of Armador and El Dorado counties, approximately 24 miles from the scene of Jeff's murder. It was theorized at the time the van could have made it to that spot in 27 minutes if they had been going the speed limit, or obviously faster had they exceeded it. Ultimately, the two decedents were identified as 43-year-old Alan Everett Schubert of Sacramento and friend Nicole Ann Welch, 28, of the North Highlands area, approximately 50 miles from where the van was found. Their cause of death was later determined to have been due to carbon monoxide poisoning. At the time, Sheriff McGinnis put forth the possibility that the van could have gotten stuck in the river, and when the water blocked up the tailpipe, the two had succumbed to carbon monoxide. However, not everyone agreed, and in the years since, it's been made quite clear that they found no evidence to show that is how they died. Not to mention, the van wasn't submerged, so the doors could be opened, and Schubert and Welch could have gotten out. Beyond that, Schubert had experience as a mechanic and would have known better than to sit there with the engine running. Investigators questioned Schubert and Welch's families, as well as Schubert's longtime girlfriend. Schubert was later described as a man who had had problems with methamphetamine in the past and who at the time of his death was living out of the white van, which was reported to have been full of tools. According to Schubert's mother, he was out in the Slough House area that night taking Welch to visit a friend. Who that friend was has never been revealed, nor the nature of that visit. It was also noted that Schubert should have carried between $300 and $600 on him at the time. Police specifically asked this, though they've never specified how much money was found in the van, if any. In terms of the van being in the river, as it turned out, there was a campground on the other side which Welch had been to before. According to later interviews, investigators stated that Schubert and Welch had left the North Highlands area at approximately 9 p.m. on October 26th, the day before. It's their belief that they met up with someone, likely at that camping location, but what happened from there is unknown. So, of course, the question became, Was this just a strange coincidence of two white vans in the area, or was this the Chevy connected to the murder of Deputy Mitchell? That's a complicated question, and the answer you get depends on who you ask. At the time, Sheriff McGinnis made it clear that while they hoped to develop a link, they hadn't yet. When speaking with the Sacramento Bee, McGinnis expressed that, as of that time, neither Schubert nor Welch were being considered suspects in the case. Since the possibility existed that there could have been a different white Chevy van in the area, police continued stopping and questioning the drivers of all white Chevy vans. There were, of course, investigators who believed the link between Jeff's murder and the van found in the river had to be there, and that coincidences like that just don't happen. There was also the question of Schubert and Welch. When found in the van, they were deceased, but many investigators began to wonder if they might have been deceased and in the van when Jeff made the traffic stop. Over the course of that first weekend, homicide investigators worked long hours, with many of them not heading home for sleep until late Saturday night, having been working the case since the moment they'd gotten the call, and then returning Sunday morning after only a few hours to press on. The Sacramento County Sheriff's Department eventually released new details about both what they believed happened as well as evidence they had recovered. Ballistics tests were able to confirm that Deputy Mitchell had been killed by his own gun. Investigators theorized that, while the traffic stop had at first seemed calm, Jeff must have seen or experienced something which changed his mind, and he decided to make an arrest. It's believed that when Jeff was either patting down the driver or maneuvering to cuff him, the suspect attacked, and a brutal struggle ensued for control of Deputy Mitchell's gun. In terms of the keying of Jeff's radio, it's never been determined if Jeff had done that himself seeking help, or if maybe it had occurred due to body pressure as he wrestled with the suspect. Disturbingly, it's entirely possible those radio clicks may have occurred moments before Jeff was shot. While there is no way of knowing for sure, some believe Jeff saw something, perhaps one of the bodies, which made him attempt to cuff the suspect. Since the killer was there in that moment, he'd likely have heard dispatch trying to reach Jeff and knew he had to get away as fast as possible. Jeff was in great physical shape and was hardly a small man. Considering the violence of the struggle, there's often been a consideration that a second suspect may have been involved. However, there have also been times during which investigators have implied that while two suspects may have been present, it's possible only one was actually involved in the altercation. Unfortunately, this only leads to more questions. What did Jeff see or hear which made him realize something was wrong? And were Schubert and Welch already dead at the time the stop was made? If they were, where had they died? And were they purposefully killed with carbon monoxide, or had they been involved in some kind of an accidental situation? I think it's worth noting, carbon monoxide poisoning is frequently a risk in home-built meth labs. Had they died as the result of a non-criminal act, it seems less likely someone would be looking to dispose of their bodies rather than just calling police or even leaving them to be found by someone else. In terms of other evidence acquired by investigators, while they've often said they didn't find a lot, what they did find is extremely important. Police were able to capture fingerprints, which they believe belonged to the killer. When these prints were entered into the system, they came back with no match, meaning that whoever killed Jeff had not had their fingerprints entered into the system from any previous arrests, if in fact the killer had been arrested previously. Beyond that, investigators recovered DNA, which they also believe belongs to the killer. They have never specified where the DNA came from, though there has been a theory that it may have come from Jeff's uniform, perhaps in the form of blood, which could have been spilled during the struggle. Unfortunately, the sample they have provided only a partial profile, and investigators explained that it was not enough for them to get a match through any law enforcement systems. In their sweep of the van, police stated they recovered fibers as well as the fingerprints and DNA from both victims, none of which indicates that either Schubert or Welch had been involved in Jeff's murder. These factors are often referenced when discussing the possibility that Schubert and Welch were already dead at the time of the traffic stop, and that an unknown driver, and possibly second suspect, were planning to dispose of their remains somewhere in the rural area. Jeff's stop, and subsequently his murder, likely caused the suspect to ditch the van. One curious detail revolves around how the van was found. Schubert was in the driver's seat, and Welch was slumped over from the passenger seat. This suggests that the killer may have placed them in those seats to stage the scene and throw suspicion off himself. Sheriff McGinnis also clarified that they had discovered what had caused damage to the fence at the scene of the murder, and it was now believed to be unrelated to the crime, having occurred previously. By Monday, October 30th, investigators reported they had received well over 300 tips throughout the weekend and were working to track them down. According to the Sacramento Bee, at least one of those tips sent them to Modesto, 70 miles to the south, where a suspect was questioned. While he was cleared of involvement, he was arrested on unrelated, outstanding charges. Police have never released this suspect's name nor the details which led them to him, but they have said that he's been ruled out. By November 1st, police had received more than 800 tips, and officers were being placed in various locations near the crime scene to be able to run leads down faster. Several locals, interviewed by various newspapers, shared similar views on the crime, expressing their sadness but also their surprise that something so terrible could happen in their quiet little area. Deputy Jeff Mitchell's funeral was held on Thursday, November 3rd. The service began with a memorial open to the public, which took place at Raleigh Field, known today as Sutter Health Park, home to the Sacramento Rivercats minor league baseball team. Thousands of law enforcement officers from across the state and in surrounding states attended to pay their respects, and there were approximately 4,000 attendees. There were many speakers, from childhood friends to colleagues. There were laughs, but there were also tears. In perhaps one of the most powerful moments, Crystal's father read a letter she had written about Jeff. Crystal was in attendance looking after her son and couldn't bring herself to speak. Her letter read in part, quote, "It was only 2 weeks ago we took that trip up to the pumpkin patch on Apple Hill. I loved every minute of our lives. I'll never stop loving you, and I'll continue to raise our son so he can be the kind of man his father was. I miss you, Jeff, and my heart aches without you. But I feel your strength. Jake and I feel your love, and that will get us through." End quote. Following the ceremony, which included Sacramento County Sheriff's Department helicopters flying the missing man formation, bagpipes and mourners, including then-Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, a large procession comprised of 400 cars and more than 100 police motorcycles traveled to the Sacramento Elks Lodge for a private reception. More than 1,000 people lined the sides of the streets to pay their respects. Among them were three who stood out by their attire, work, not formal. They were investigators out of the Sacramento Central Division who elected to continue working the investigation rather than attending the ceremony, stopping only for the procession. Officer Don Vettel later told the Sacramento Bee, quote, "A lot of people are torn on whether to go to the funeral or continue the investigation. We decided to pay our respects that way and continue the investigation." End quote. Initially, a $100,000 reward for information was being offered, but by the day of the funeral, that was increased to $225,000. As of that time, investigators had received more than 1,805 tips, of which they had followed up on 1,769. But they would be looking for help from the public on one lead just a few days later. On Sunday, November 5th, investigators released still frame images of a man in a Circle K convenience store 10 miles southwest of the murder, approximately 30 minutes after. Police asked the public for their assistance in locating the man, whose name they did not release. They specified that the man was not considered a suspect, but that he may unknowingly possess information vital to their investigation. This all came out after an interview with a woman who had been with the man that night and, according to store clerks, was behaving strangely. Her behavior was so strange, she was asked several times if she needed them to call police. Police were seeking to determine whether or not the woman was connected to another tip they had received, where a witness claimed to have seen a man at the Chevron gas station across the street from the Circle K washing blood off his face that night. Police by then had received more than 2,500 tips. On Wednesday, November 8th, police announced they had found the man from the Circle K and questioned him. According to the information released to the public, the man had never been a suspect and was being sought to corroborate information given to them by the woman who had been with him. Sometime later, investigators reported that while the report of a man washing blood from his face was in fact true, they had been able to confirm that it occurred the day prior to Jeff's murder. 2 days later, on Friday, November 10th, the sheriff's department noted they were now over 3,000 tips. Sheriff McGinnis told the Sacramento Bee that they also had three suspects in custody on unrelated charges who would be taking DNA tests. For locals living in the area of Slough House and neighboring Wilton, paranoia was on the rise as investigators began focusing in tighter. Many residents began to wonder if it was possible they had a killer living amongst them, or worse yet, someone they knew and had spent time with. One resident who faced scrutiny from police was Kevin Heffley of Wilton. Heffley owned and drove a white Plymouth minivan with no plate. After interviewing Heffley, investigators allegedly returned to his home at least four times conducting searches of his property. When reached by the Sacramento Bee, Sheriff spokesman Tim Curran stated that Heffley was not a suspect, but they had to follow up on tips they'd been receiving. By November 18th, the investigation was entering its fourth week and tips began slowing down. During a press conference, Curran explained that while they were working the case hard, they were hitting roadblocks, which was very frustrating, but they were continuing to move forward. Crystal, alongside Jeff's mother, attended and spoke to the media saying that her son is what keeps her going, as most days she struggles to even get moving. Crystal explained, quote, "Thank God I have that. I have to get out of bed in the morning and take Jake to school. I have to be a mom." End quote. While investigators continued trying to find Jeff's killer, they also noted how important it was that the public share information. In hopes of encouraging this, they put up more than 20 billboards with new information about the murder, as well as the $225,000 reward and a special tip line. But by year's end, nothing new had emerged, at least not publicly. In total, over the course of 2 months, more than 14,000 man hours had been utilized in the investigation, with expenses exceeding $1 million, more than half of which was for overtime. In February, 4 months after Jeff's murder, Sheriff McGinnis spoke with the Sacramento Bee and revealed a new piece of information. McGinnis explained, quote, "We have consistently gotten tips that the killer is from another country. That is consistent with the lack of a fingerprint match. We have to take seriously the possibility that he's hiding across the border." End quote. McGinnis also mentioned for the first time that since Deputy Mitchell had been killed with his own gun, they had quietly conducted an investigation to rule out the possibility that the wound could have been self-inflicted. After multiple firearms experts and forensic pathologists were brought in, they all came to the conclusion that this was absolutely a homicide and nothing else. While they had never really believed Jeff would have taken his own life, they had to examine that possibility in order to be thorough. McGinnis also stated that the number of investigators working the case had been scaled back, down to 6 working full-time and 6 working part-time. In May of 2007, 6 months after Deputy Mitchell's murder, Jeff was added to a memorial of Sacramento law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty. Investigators noted that the case was not cold, they were still pursuing active leads, but simply hadn't managed to connect any potential suspect to the physical evidence. By this time, 3 investigators were working the case. More than 4,000 tips had been received, and over 50 thick 3-ring binders had been filled with information related to the case. Crystal spoke to reporters after the memorial, at which time she explained, quote, "I really can't go forward in my grieving process because I know there is a significant piece of this that is unresolved. It's like a wound that's left open. Jeff always told Jake that bad guys go to jail for their bad deeds. I want him to have faith in that." End quote. Crystal would attend another service a week later in Washington, D.C., at which time Jeff was added to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, along with 382 other police officers killed in the line of duty. Jeffrey Mitchell was the 14th Sacramento County Sheriff's deputy added to that memorial. Over the course of the next few years, while the case was actively being investigated, there were, for the most part, no major developments. However, Crystal worked hard to keep Jeff's name alive and to keep awareness of his case in the public consciousness. A permanent monument to Jeff was constructed along Mace Road at the location where he was killed. Surrounded on three sides by a wrought iron fence, the monument includes a cross and a brass plaque. In addition, there are two ceramic plaques, one bearing Jeff's name, the other reading, "Happy Birthday, Daddy, May 28th, 2007. There was also a bench facing the memorial, where visitors could sit. But at some point in time, some complete scumbag stole that bench, which was replaced with a new one, engraved with Jeff's name, that was then bolted to a concrete slab installed in front of the monument. What kind of garbage people steal from a memorial, I'll never know. The following year, in 2008, 1 mile of road with the memorial in its center was renamed Sacramento County Deputy Sheriff Jeffrey Mitchell Memorial Roadway. In 2009, a baseball field in El Dorado Hills, where Jeff lived, was renovated and a memorial for local heroes was erected. The field was officially renamed Jeff Mitchell Field and Public Service Memorial on August 29th. Westmont High School holds a memorial alumni game each year named in honor of Jeff, and both his name and badge number have been worn through marathons, both on foot and bicycle. 2 years later, in August of 2011, lead investigator Tony Turnbull, a friend of Jeff since before either entered law enforcement, sat down to talk with CBS 13. During the interview, Turnbull revealed that investigators believed they were getting closer to capturing Jeff's killer. He explained that police believed Jeff was killed because he came upon the van that night and that the killer was trying to conceal the bodies. When asked about the killer's identity, Turnbull revealed they had more than one person of interest, and at least one of those persons knows they're being looked at closely. According to Turnbull, several people interviewed who know the person of interest have tried to cover for him. Turnbull stated, quote, "We know these people have associates that they're very close to, and we know that some of these people have lied thus far, and it's time for them to come forward," end quote. He went on to describe interviews with their associates as a web of lies. According to Turnbull, investigators believe there are multiple people who know what happened that night, who have either directly lied or have been uncooperative with the investigation. 2 years later, in 2013, it was announced that DNA evidence obtained from the crime scene was being resubmitted for lab analysis. Since technology had dramatically improved since 2006, it was hoped a full profile might be developed from the evidence gathered. It was also during this time that it became quite clear, regardless of what had been previously stated, investigators had no doubt that the white van found in the river was connected to Jeff's murder. While police apparently have at least two people they're looking at, and have been looking at for years, the hold comes up in the form of evidence. They have suggested that they're missing just one key piece, which would allow them to finally make an arrest. It's their hope that someone in the community will come forward. In November of 2020, 14 years and 1 month since the murder of Deputy Mitchell, Turnbull took part in a new series of interviews. When speaking to ABC 10, Turnbull stated, quote, "After 14 years, we have made a lot of strides. To say there are no suspects or persons of interest would be lying to you. We've looked at people strongly, and they've not been ruled out yet. Are we there? I think we're close. I can't give you a time frame, but I can honestly say we're probably not far away. We just need something or somebody to put us over the top," end quote. Sacramento County Sheriff's Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell was shot and killed during a traffic stop in the early morning hours of October 27, 2006. Over the course of the past 14 and a half years, the investigation has never stopped. Police firmly believe that whoever was driving the white Chevy van that night engaged in a violent and brutal struggle with Jeff until he managed to wrestle away his gun and kill him. There's also a good chance that whoever killed Jeff possesses information regarding the deaths of Alan Schubert and Nicole Welch, whose bodies were found in that van. Police are in possession of both fingerprints and a partial DNA profile of the suspected killer, and have at least two persons of interest they have not ruled out. It's been suggested that one of those persons was present that night, while likely not involved in the crime, but has also not come forward and shared information with investigators out of fear. It's strongly believed that other people in the area know the truth and have both lied and been uncooperative in order to protect the killer. It's a difficult thing to accept. In a dark world, Jeff Mitchell was a bright light. He loved his job and worked hard to serve and protect. The myriad of comments from friends, colleagues, and even people he met through investigations shows his quality, his honor, and how horrible his loss has been. For his family, not a day goes by where they don't hope that they'll finally get the call that the killer has been arrested. To this day, Crystal keeps Jeff close to her heart and in her home. The badge he was wearing the night he was killed is kept behind glass, along with awards and citations he earned during his life. At the top is a flag, the flag which was draped over his coffin. She has taken her grief and utilized it to help others, being a mentor and friend to those who have lost their spouses in the line of duty. She continues to visit Jeff's memorial along Mace Road whenever she wishes to talk with him, be near him, or just feel him. Jeff Mitchell was just 38 years old when he was taken from his wife and son. Jake is now in his early 20s and doing well, seemingly following in his father's own athletic footsteps. There's nothing that can ever replace what was taken, nor that which can relieve the pain endured by all who loved Jeff. Justice, however, can be delivered, and closure so elusive could be given to all who will never forget their friend, brother, son, partner, husband, and father. On a memorial page for Jeff, Crystal wrote the following. Although life for us as the living goes on, not a day goes by that you aren't loved, missed, and thought about. I was blessed to have been your wife and best friend for 15 years. We have missed out on so much in life, and it makes me sad to think about the what-ifs. Instead, I choose to do what I know you would want, to live life to the fullest for both of us. I know that you are with Jake and I every step we take on our new journey in life, and that you help guide us towards those things that bring us happiness and laughter. I know what it is you would want for us. I wish you were here for us to laugh and be happy with, but I take comfort in having you with me every moment in my heart and soul. I will love you and miss you always. Is there something standing in the way of your happiness? Something that keeps you from achieving your goals? I've been there more times than I'd like to admit. There's nothing wrong with admitting that you could use some help, and thankfully there's a great service available to you, BetterHelp. BetterHelp assesses your needs and provides you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can easily connect to a safe, secure, and private online environment to discuss the things that are weighing you down. BetterHelp is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done conveniently and securely online. You can message your counselor anytime and receive thoughtful responses. You can schedule weekly video or phone sessions right from the comfort of your own home. No uncomfortable waiting rooms. One thing I really love about BetterHelp is the affordability. It's less costly than traditional offline counseling, and they even offer financial aid. Find the help you need, not just what's offered by counselors close to home. BetterHelp provides licensed professional counselors who specialize in depression, stress, anxiety, relationships, sleeping, trauma, and so much more. Most importantly, with BetterHelp, everything you share is confidential, and counseling is offered securely and conveniently. So many people are using BetterHelp that they've been recruiting additional counselors across all 50 states. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/trace. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/trace. On a cold, dark stretch of road in the rural edges of Sacramento County, a deputy sheriff initiates a traffic stop for a license plate violation. Sitting in his cruiser, he reaches over to the computer and types a short message to notify dispatch of what he's doing and where he is. Basic safety protocol. The last words he transmits specify he sees only one person in the vehicle and that everything seemed okay. Less than 7 minutes later, he is shot and hangs on for just over an hour before he succumbs to a lethal head wound. In a window of less than 430 seconds, his 38 years are brought to a brutal and violent end. For the last 14, his family has had to go on without him, without justice, while his killer remains free. The investigation began almost immediately, and while police didn't have a whole lot to go on, they knew what they were looking for, a white Chevy van with no tags. Time was of the essence. Each minute that ticked by allowed the driver of that van to put more distance between himself and the police in pursuit. The vehicle description was put out rapidly, being broadcast all along major highways in California and to law enforcement agencies within hundreds of miles, across California and into Nevada. The Sacramento County Sheriff's Department was assisted by multiple agencies from other sheriff's departments, the California Highway Patrol, local and neighboring police departments, and even the FBI. Before the sun came up, there were hundreds of law enforcement officers either actively searching for the van or at least keeping an eye out for it. I've covered a lot of unsolved homicides across the previous 149 episodes of Trace Evidence. Generally speaking, one of the most frustrating and difficult aspects of an investigation is the loss of time. When someone isn't discovered for hours or days, when the suspect has time to get away, destroy evidence, clean up and distance themselves from anyone who might look at them suspiciously. There's a reason the first 48 hours of an investigation are considered the most critical. The evidence is fresh and, in a manner of speaking, there's an ability to gather clues and follow them to the next and next. But the more time passes, the higher the likelihood that evidence can be destroyed or lost. While circumstances can surely change and different variables have different effects, the general statistics show that after those first 48 hours pass, the chances of solving the crime decrease by as much as 50%, depending on what study you're relying on. It took approximately 12 hours before the van was found, and at the time, there was some confusion about whether or not that was in fact the same van Jeff had stopped. It didn't make any sense. How does a sheriff's deputy get gunned down during a traffic stop and the van ends up halfway through a river, sitting in 8 inches of water, with two dead people inside and not a single indication that either of them was involved in the crime? There's nothing simple about a homicide investigation, but this one surely adds layers and levels of complications that no one could have foreseen. All these years later, there seems to be a more cohesive theory about what may have happened that night, but in the moment, there were a lot of questions and doubts. While some believed that that was absolutely the right van, others thought it had to be some kind of a coincidence. I'm not much of a believer in coincidence, especially ones like this would have to be, but you can't really blame them. They expect to find the killer in the van. They expect to find evidence linking one of the victims to the shooting, and instead, all they find is a larger mystery. How exactly did Alan Schubert and Nicole Welch die? Was it before or after the shooting? Were they connected to the killer, or was he responsible for their deaths also? Over all these years, some of the questions have been answered, though many more still remain, and the mystery at the heart of this case falls into the small, 7-minute window of time between Jeff's last message and the clicking of his radio. You'd imagine in a case like this, there'd be a wide array of theories, though for the most part, there isn't. This is an unsolved case that in many ways is unlike the vast majority that I've covered in the past. If someone's murdered in their home, you try to narrow the motive. Is anything missing? Did they have any enemies? Did they owe anyone money? When the crime happens outside of the home, you begin to look at exactly where it occurred, trying to discern why it happened there. Is this a place they frequented where a killer targeting them might plan to strike? Is it a violent area where other murders have occurred? In worst-case scenarios, you end up coming to the least desired conclusion, that perhaps there was nothing specific about the crime, that it's more random in nature. Random murders are especially challenging because of the basic motives, means, and opportunity become more difficult to apply. Was there a reason Or was someone just in the wrong place at the wrong time? Jeff's case unfortunately falls somewhat into that random scenario. It doesn't appear that the killer was out there looking for him. In fact, logic dictates he was probably doing the best he could to avoid being seen by anyone. As fate or bad luck would have it, Jeff just happened to turn onto the same road the van was on, noticed an issue with the license plate, and what was supposed to be a fairly normal traffic stop, as normal as one of them can ever be, somehow transformed into a fight for survival, ending in the murder of a son, brother, father, and husband. In most episodes, we'd look at different theories and try to weigh them out. What's more likely? What's a little beyond the pale? But here, there are no solid theories to really look at. This isn't a situation where we can say this was someone Jeff knew. Was this someone who targeted him? Was this someone who felt they had a reason to want to do him harm? All we can do is look at what we do know and see where that leads us. So let's begin with the stop itself. According to everything we know, it was all about the absence of a license plate. This is a confusing detail in and of itself because when the van was later found, it had tags. The front one was bent up, making it difficult to see, but there was a rear plate. Jeff, following protocol, sends in a message about the van but also specifies no plate. If he were behind the van, he'd have seen the rear plate if it had been on at that time, and he'd likely have sent the plate number along with his message. So you've got a few different possibilities. Either there was no rear plate at the time of the stop, or it was covered up somehow, or you're looking at the wrong van. But we'll get more into the van a little later. Now, we obviously don't know what happened, but the most common theory which police have put together is that sometime after making that stop, something about the situation shifted. This is a traffic stop which begins about a plate violation and, based on evidence at the scene, was going to become an arrest. This is considered likely because Jeff's cuffs were found on the ground. So investigators believe that at some point, Jeff either saw or heard something, or the driver did something, which made him believe he needed to be cuffed. There's a lot of different possibilities. Jeff could have seen the bodies, the driver could have said something threatening, the driver could have been uncooperative, or maybe something else entirely. However, it may be more likely that the driver didn't resist at all, but instead was extremely cooperative until he saw an opportunity. It's extremely difficult to handcuff a suspect who's actively resisting. In many cases, even two police officers struggle to get the cuffs on someone who's fighting back or trying to wriggle away. There are various techniques taught to combine restraining a suspect's arm while taking them off their feet in order to get them down where you can have better leverage and control to get the cuffs on. Now, this is purely speculation on my part, but Jeff being an intelligent man with several years' experience as a deputy, it seems likely if the suspect was resisting or showing signs of being uncooperative from the get-go, the best choice would be to keep the suspect there, draw his firearm, and radio for backup, holding the suspect in place until assistance could arrive. I find it hard to believe that by himself on a dark road in the middle of the night, knowing the nearest backup is likely 10 to 15 minutes away, Deputy Mitchell would decide to just take the risk and see if he could subdue the suspect himself. Obviously, given the rural nature of the location, maybe calling for backup isn't something you'd want to do because of how long it's going to take, but if the choice is between waiting for backup or possibly not going home, the smart money is on calling for backup. Since that doesn't happen here, it seems probable that the suspect was polite, agreeable, and went along with every direction Jeff gave him. Maybe he was even local, someone Jeff may have seen in the area before. When the decision was made to cuff the suspect, Jeff likely would have told him to face away, spread his feet apart, and place his hands behind his back, with his palms touching. Law enforcement training tells you that even if a suspect is cooperative, you have to anticipate that they could turn violent, and once you're within 6 feet of them, you are in the danger zone. This is why you often see police forcing people to the ground before cuffing them, even if they're cooperating, because you simply never know when things could turn. In this situation, whether it was Jeff's well-known kindness that came into effect, or perhaps a quick, well-planned maneuver by the suspect, this is where the struggle likely begins, and you can imagine it fairly easily. Jeff holsters his weapon, reaches for the suspect's wrist, the suspect makes his move. At this point, things turn bad. The fight begins, and now you've got Jeff, handcuffs dropped to the ground, wrestling with the suspect who is fighting with everything he has to escape arrest. At some point, It becomes a struggle for control over Jeff's weapon, whether that was Jeff drawing it and both men fighting over it, or perhaps the suspect reaching for it and Jeff trying to stop him. Now, Jeff is not a small man, nor is he out of shape, so I imagine one of a few possibilities. The suspect is as big, if not bigger, than Jeff. The suspect has experience and skill in fighting. The suspect is on a drug which gives him the ability to fight harder, or perhaps there's a second person involved. There's also the possibility that when the suspect made his initial move, he was able to catch Jeff completely off guard, either grounding him or disorienting him enough to gain control quickly. Although this seems less likely, based on police statements, Jeff got in enough shots on the suspect to cause some damage. At some point, Jeff's radio is keyed, and this either occurs from the two men's bodies colliding during the struggle or after the fatal shot. Somehow, the suspect manages to get control of the gun, either firing it in mid-struggle or wrestling it away and having a few feet of space to level the weapon and fire. Once that shot's fired, the suspect doesn't have a lot of time to decide what he's going to do. He drops the gun at the scene, gets in the van, and flees. Whether or not he hears dispatch trying to reach Jeff and decides to run, or was already gone by the time those calls began, we don't know. However, it's interesting to note that since Jeff's weapon was used, either the suspect didn't have one of his own, or he wasn't able to get to it. I do find it somewhat curious that he left the gun behind, though. He had to know he could have left behind fingerprints or DNA. Given the circumstances, even if he hadn't heard dispatch trying to reach Jeff, he had to know that shooting a police officer was going to result in a massive hunt. Yet, for some reason, he doesn't take the gun. Maybe that lends credence to the possibility that the gun was fired during the struggle, or maybe the suspect panicked and wasn't paying much attention to what he did after that shot was fired. When Deputy Sutter arrived, he located Jeff on the pavement behind the rear bumper of his cruiser. Now, if police do know, they've never stated, but this makes me wonder if the struggle began and occurred mostly in and around the rear of Jeff's cruiser, or if the fight moved from another area and eventually ended at that spot. It's also possible Jeff directed the suspect to the rear of the cruiser, where he was going to lean him over the trunk during the cuffing process. This is an act commonly seen performed by police, though it affords the suspect a small advantage because he can push off from the back of the car, gaining leverage and power in an attempt to strike the officer to overcome him, so it's advised not to do this. The next area which becomes a crime scene for investigators is the van. 12 hours after Jeff is shot, a white Chevy van was spotted in the Cosumnes River. The exact location in which the van was found is approximately 20 miles northeast of where Jeff was shot. According to Sergeant Turnbull, it's believed the driver went to this spot immediately following the murder. If one were going the speed limit, it would take approximately 27 minutes to reach, which means the van likely arrived there between 3:54 and 4:05 a.m. The van was sitting in the middle of the river, though I should note this particular spot is extremely shallow, with the water level climbing just 8 inches. According to investigators, there's a campground area on the other side of the river, which is accessible by driving through the river. Whether the van was stuck, stalled, or was purposefully left in that location has never been clarified. The van fit Deputy Mitchell's description almost to a T, the only difference being that this van had plates. The front plate was severely bent up in a position where it's difficult to see, and when the van was removed from the water, there was a rear plate attached. This makes me wonder if Jeff may have been driving towards the van when he initiated the stop, noticing only an issue with the front plate. Since in California, you have to have plates on both front and back, this would still be a plate violation. However, assuming he pulled behind the van, he would have clearly seen the rear plate unless it wasn't on the van at the time, which would imply that in the 27 minutes after the murderer killed Jeff, he took the time to put the plate back on or maybe remove something which was obstructing it. I don't fully understand the rationale behind doing anything to conceal the plates, as that would only increase the chances of being pulled over. If you're driving bodies, you don't want police to have any reason to stop you. The plate issue in this case is one which remains bizarre and confusing. In the van, police find the bodies of Alan Schubert and Nicole Welch, both deceased. Schubert was the van's owner and lived out of it. There were tools, cooking equipment, and various items in the back. Everything in the van was processed by police looking for any evidence, but if any was found, they haven't made it public. I really wish we knew whether or not any of that equipment had been tested to show whether or not it had been used in the production of any kind of drugs. Based on the condition of Schubert and Welch's bodies, there was nothing to indicate either had been involved in a violent physical altercation. Schubert had no bruising or wounds either on his face, body, or most importantly, his hands. This caused a lot of confusion early on, since if this was the van, why didn't any of the occupants match the injuries and marks they'd expect to find? That question got a partial answer when autopsies determined both occupants had died as the result of carbon monoxide poisoning. At the time, it was theorized one of two ways. Either Schubert and Welch had been at the murder site and were either killed or took their own lives through carbon monoxide poisoning on that spot in the river, or they were already dead at the time Jeff pulled the van over. The latter is considered most likely, as that fills in the blanks as to why the driver may have attacked Jeff. He knew he had two dead people in that van, one of whom was the registered owner. Both Schubert and Welch were in the front seats, but it's since been speculated that they were placed there at the time the van was stopped. Surely this is something a single person could do, but it would have been easier if someone was helping. Perhaps this was done to throw investigators off, to make them think Schubert or Welch were the killers, or to just buy the killer time to get further away. In all reality, and by all accounts, the most likely scenario seems to be that Schubert and Welch died, and the driver was taking their bodies to that campground or somewhere else. Whether that was to conceal their remains, stage a different scene, or for some other reason, we simply don't know. But if the van did get stuck rather than being purposefully left there, it may lend more credence to the idea that while the driver was familiar with the location to some degree, he may not have been familiar with the area of the river where it was safest to ford, or perhaps he was so panicked he veered off course. There is also the possibility that the killer had a reason for returning to that campsite, which had little to do with Schubert or Welch. Maybe there was something there he needed, personal possessions, evidence of a crime, or even his own vehicle. If they had met up around there and then gone off together in the van, it's possible the killer's car or truck was there. He knows he can't drive that van very long. They're looking for it everywhere. So he's got to get back to his car and get out of town. When you look at the area around the campground, there's nothing for miles. The closest cities are Plymouth, around 10 miles to the south, or El Dorado, 12 miles to the north. It's between abandoned mining camps, some active campgrounds, and a lot of open space and wilderness. It would make sense if he wanted to get to his car and get out of town. There's also the possibility that he could have been in touch with someone else and gave them a location at which to pick him up. Were that the case, it would solidify that the killer has connections to the area. The fact of the matter is, if he didn't have his own mode of transportation or the option to call someone to come and collect him, the only other choice would be to hide out in the woods or at a campground that wasn't being used at the time. In the end, not much was learned from the van, though it did introduce investigators to Schubert and Welch, who then became main targets. While they were ruled out as being the killers early on, there was a chance they had known the killer and had been with him that day. During interviews with friends and family, police learned that Schubert was giving Welch a ride up into the area to meet a friend. We know they left North Highlands around 9 p.m. on the 26th, 6 hours before Jeff was killed. From Welch's home to the spot where the van was found is approximately 50 miles in a one-hour drive. If that's where they'd originally gone, then logic would dictate they left the campground at some point that night and were being driven back when Jeff pulled up on the scene. Now, according to Schubert's mother, he told her he was taking Welch up into the area of Jackson to meet a friend. Jackson is approximately 17 miles south of where the van was found and about 25 miles from the spot where Jeff was killed. Interestingly enough, police spent a lot of time focusing in on the town of Wilton, which is south of where Jeff was killed and west of Jackson. Were one to drive from Jackson to Wilton, one route to take would be along California State Road 16, also known as Jackson Road, which is approximately 4 miles north of Mace Road, where Jeff was killed. Even more curiously, another route someone could take would involve driving along Mace Road itself. So it's possible that Schubert and Welch met up with someone in Jackson, traveled to Wilton, where they may have died, and then were being brought back towards the campground area when Jeff arrived. It's also possible that they had met with someone in Jackson itself. The only reason to be traveling along Mace Road that night, if the destination is that campground, is because you're beginning your trip to the west of Mace Road. It's not the route you'd normally take, though. Jackson Road would be faster, but if you're trying to avoid being seen or running into police or anyone else, you might opt to take Mace Road. Mace Road, far more rural and less traveled, on its eastern end connects to Ione Road, which travels north to Jackson Road, and east to several back roads which can be used to get either to Jackson Road or State Route 49, off which the van was found. If the point of origination was Jackson, or anywhere east of the murder scene, there would be no reason to be traveling on Mace Road at all. Sadly, while that may open up more options, this is a case that needs a reduction in possibilities rather than an expansion. Of course, Jackson itself could have been the original intended destination rather than the campground. If the driver were leaving from somewhere in the west, such as Wilton, and planning to get to Jackson, or perhaps back to Jackson, then Mace Road is still a viable option. Rather than splitting off and going north towards the campground, you'd continue down Mace, at which point several options arise that could bring you to Jackson. Route 88 and 124, for instance. While the distance from where Jeff was killed to the campsite was approximately 20 miles, the distance to Jackson was 25. Did the traffic stop cause a major change in plans for the killer, who could live in Jackson or have connections there, or was he always going to the campsite? The answer to that question, if ever unlocked, might provide much more information about the killer and his travels that night. Unfortunately, we're just left with more questions. Who was Welch meeting that day, and was that person knowledgeable about the campsite? If Welch and Schubert had died due to carbon monoxide poisoning prior to the murder of Deputy Mitchell, why was someone transporting their bodies in the first place? The only reason I could imagine someone doing this would be if they had died in a place that would tie them to their deaths, or if they had died in the process of an illegal activity. There is, of course, a third possibility. Now, this is purely my own speculation, and I have nothing solid to lead me to this thought, other than it's possible. What if Welch and Schubert were alive when the murder took place, and afterward, then the killer killed them? Perhaps using the van as a source to poison them with carbon monoxide, maybe through some other means. Unfortunately, it's difficult to know because no estimate on their times of death has ever been released. We don't know a lot about either Schubert or Welch, although according to Schubert's mother, he had been arrested in the past for drug possession, vandalism, and driving under the influence. Multiple articles noted that he had issues with meth. I haven't been able to locate criminal records for Welch, though the news did post a photo of her that's clearly a mugshot, so I don't think it's far-fetched to imagine she'd at least had one run-in with the law. I don't like to be presumptuous or leap to conclusions, but when you have two people, one with a history of meth abuse, traveling together in an area where meth is on the rise, it's difficult for me to completely accept that their deaths had nothing to do with drugs. I also think it's worth noting that death due to carbon monoxide poisoning is fairly common for people who are manufacturing methamphetamine in their own makeshift labs, often housed in small outdoor buildings such as sheds, campers, or sometimes even in their own kitchens. At the same time, I think it's important to say nothing has ever come out which ties Schubert or Welch to any specific activities that day outside of meeting this so-called friend. There's never been evidence produced or details presented which tie them to any illegal activity that day, be it related to drugs or anything else. Because they both have criminal histories, it's easy to believe that that's what was happening, but there's always the chance that they weren't out there looking for anything that would have put them in a dangerous situation. Whoever this friend of Welch's was probably holds a lot of those answers. While we could easily say yes, manufacturing meth in makeshift labs can often lead to death by way of carbon monoxide poisoning, that could also be a way to murder people, whereby the manner of death wouldn't necessarily raise a lot of questions. How often have you heard of someone with a history of meth use dying due to carbon monoxide poisoning, and it's just automatically determined that they died in the process of making more methamphetamine, rather than the possibility that perhaps someone locked them in a room or by some other means managed to kill them through the use of carbon monoxide poisoning, knowing that when they were found and their histories discovered, there'd be few questions about their manner of death. According to Welch's family, she was putting her life back together and working towards a better future. She was just 28 years old when her life was ended, and after all this time, there doesn't appear to be any clear answer about exactly what happened. In terms of Schubert, he was 43, and while he'd had issues in the past, he hadn't been arrested in several years. At the time, he was living out of that van, but according to his girlfriend, the two of them were planning to move into a place together the next month. Schubert was making money through odd jobs, and in the days before his death had been paid for paving a driveway. How much of that money disappeared along with the exact details of how he and Welch died, we can't say at the moment. But I do think we have to entertain the possibility that Deputy Mitchell was not the only person who had his life ended by the shooter that night. If indeed Welch and Schubert's deaths were homicide through carbon monoxide poisoning, then the hunt is truly for someone who has the blood of three people on his hands. It appears from statements made by investigators that there's likely a connection between Schubert, Welch, and Welch's friend that leads to their deaths. Once they are dead and the decision is made to dump the bodies, at least one person has to make that drive, and the most likely candidate is either Welch's friend or whoever Welch and Schubert would have gone to see after seeing that friend. More than likely, Welch's friend has some knowledge of who may have been involved, if not having been directly involved him or herself. In several interviews, it's been hinted that there may have been a second person present at the murder who was not involved in the crime but was with the killer. Police have made it clear they've spoken to people close to the suspect who have lied to protect him. Police noted several people told them that the killer was from another country. Whether that means someone who has an accent, someone they know for a fact is from another country, or just the person looks like they're from another country, I honestly don't know. I do know police mentioned that the killer may be hiding in Mexico, so I'm left to wonder if that could be the person's home country. So the question becomes, who are people more likely to protect? A local Jackson person who was friends with Welch, or a mysterious man from Mexico who, for whatever reason, was in the area driving Welch and Schubert's bodies that night? My money would be on the local, the person people know and have an interest in protecting. However, there's also the possibility that the other man could be frightening enough that no one wants to give up any information on him. If this case is indeed connected to drugs in some way, shape, or form, then you've got the possibility you could be looking at someone who may have a connection to a Mexican cartel. This is not a random leap I'm making here without any reason. Over the course of the past 14 years, there have been many drug busts in Sacramento County with connections to Mexican cartels. Just 2 weeks ago, Operation Burnt Orange concluded with the arrest of 44 people and the seizure of 1,100 pounds of meth, 500 grams of fentanyl, 40 pounds of cocaine and heroin, and more than $200 in cash, along with almost a dozen guns, including assault rifles and rocket launchers. The operation was being tracked for months, running all over the Bay Area. In 2010, the DEA seized 610 pounds of meth, 16 pounds of cocaine, guns, and ledgers, which detailed the distribution of more than 3,000 pounds of meth in just a six-month period. They arrested a Sacramento man with ties to the cartels who was running a major distribution hub in the area. Now, none of this means that cartels are involved or that this case revolves around drug runners, but I really don't know that it's a possibility we can completely rule out. A suspect whose prints are not in the system, who no one wants to dime out to investigators. It wouldn't be shocking if you're looking at a very dangerous person who has no criminal record in the U.S., because he's never actually been arrested on U.S. soil. Now, pulling back a little bit, this doesn't mean that the cartels have to be involved. It doesn't even mean that the killers have to have any connections to the cartels. You could just be talking about a Mexican citizen who's involved in some illegal activity that connects them to someone from Jackson, which in turn connects them to Schubert and Welch. Frankly, had a cartel been involved, I don't think Schubert and Welch would have been being transported in Schubert's own van, but more than likely they would have been disposed of in a way where they were never going to be found. I should note, I've never heard anyone working on this case make any reference to cartels, but I have seen some minor discussion about it and that possibility from locals commenting on the murder of Jeff Mitchell. While this is surely an interesting angle to examine, to bring it all back to California, there's several details which seem to imply that someone connected to the murder of Deputy Mitchell was, at the time, either local to the area or had a high level of familiarity with it. You've got potential connections to Jackson and Wilton. You have a driver slash shooter who knows the back roads well enough to avoid Jackson Road while being able to make it back towards the campsite which I find it difficult to believe anyone would know was even there unless they'd been there before. Maybe the most telling detail, though, is in what police have said about people lying to protect someone. If they've interviewed friends and family who've helped cover up for this person, it's unlikely that person lives somewhere far away out of the reach of police. Why risk the possibility of being charged with obstruction of justice to protect someone that's in an area where they're not going to be caught anyway? In the state of California, obstruction of justice occurs whenever someone lies to police during an investigation or knowingly participates in the hiding or destruction of evidence or materials which would be useful in proving the crime. It also covers anyone attempting to stop someone else from providing information or evidence. Someone who obstructs justice can be charged with either a misdemeanor or felony, which can result in prison time. It's also worth noting that supplying a false alibi for someone who committed a crime can result in a charge of being an accessory after the fact, and in a murder case, that can result in a life sentence in California, especially a case such as this, which is technically a capital murder case because it involved the murder of a law enforcement officer. This would also apply to acting as a lookout or helping the killer escape. Beyond that, there are many other laws which could be applicable, including but not limited to criminal conspiracy, aiding and abetting, and attempted crimes. I don't know about you, but I'm not willing to be hit with any of these charges to protect someone who not only killed a police officer, but who did so in the process of transporting two people who died under what I can only call bizarre circumstances. That's essentially where we stand today. More than 4,000 leads have been investigated, and police reports and documents are stored in more than 30 large binders. Investigators say they have persons of interest who they haven't ruled out. They've caught people lying in defense of at least one person and believe these people know what happened. There is undoubtedly a link to the area for someone who was either directly involved or possesses knowledge about who was. There are fingerprints, though no matches. There's DNA, but not enough for a profile. It's almost a tip-of-the-tongue situation. It's right there within reach. But that one vital piece which could be utilized to complete the picture, file charges, and make an arrest evades capture. Surely someone out there has the ability to aid investigators, but for now, chooses not to. Jeffrey Vaughn Mitchell was 38 years old when he was shot and killed during a traffic stop in Sacramento County over 14 years ago. He left behind siblings, parents, a wife, and a six-year-old son, all of whom hoped to see justice served, to see the killer arrested, charged, and sentenced. To this day, both relatives and investigators stop by Jeff's memorial to pay their respects, quietly reflect, and hope that someday soon they can find what they need to finally close the case. Both Alan Schubert and Nicole Welch also lost their lives and left behind grieving friends and family. How exactly did the 43-year-old and 28-year-old die from carbon monoxide poisoning? Where did it happen? And who exactly may have been transporting their bodies that night? According to Sergeant Turnbull, they're so close to having what they need. This is a case which, despite the passage of time, has never truly gone cold. From the first moments of the investigation to today, leads have been worked, persons of interest examined, and evidence analyzed. As technology continues to progress, the likelihood that the DNA found will eventually be capable of developing a full profile increases. The clock is running, and investigators are certain they're going to make an arrest. Of course, if only someone with knowledge would come forward and share what they know, the wheels could be set in motion so much sooner. Until someone stands up, even anonymously, and shares what they know, police manage to find new evidence or match those fingerprints, or technology gets to where it can pull the truth from that DNA, the murder of Sheriff's Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell will remain open and unsolved. If you're looking for more information about the murder of Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell, there are many websites and forums discussing his case. The Sacramento Bee did extensive coverage from the day the murder occurred through today, as did ABC 10, who covered it on their special Unsolved California show, available on YouTube or at their website. You can also visit the Facebook page, Deputy Jeff Mitchell Memorial, which has information about Jeff's life, and whenever an update is posted, it is shared on that page. If you have any information about the murder of Deputy Jeffrey Mitchell and or Alan Schubert and Nicole Welch, you can contact the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department at 916-874-5057. You can also contact the Sacramento Field Office for the FBI at 916-746-7000. You can visit tips.fbi.gov to report an anonymous tip. You can also call the Sacramento Valley Crime Stoppers at 1-800-AA-CRIME, or you can report tips anonymously on their website at sacvalleycrimestoppers.com. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eamon Brady, James, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Kevin Bonham, Marla Wright, Melissa Breckeisen, Michael Draves, Nick Mohar-Schurz, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levinen, Sarah Mascaritolo, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Vox Nihili. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode, episode 150. Sometimes it's difficult for me to believe we've already done 150 episodes. It feels like the show just began yesterday. However, none of this would be possible without amazing listeners like you. Over the past few years, we've been lucky enough to see some of those 150 cases solved, and here's hoping that we'll see many more solved as we move steadily towards episode 200. So thanks everyone so much for your support. It means the world to me, and I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.